Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and we're going to spend the rest of the hour on the new Supreme Court term that started on Monday. The justices heard a case out of Wisconsin yesterday on gerrymandering. You can find our show on the issue on my webpage and on the podcast. And the court has a busy agenda through the fall to help us sort it out. We've asked Kimberly Atkins to join us. She's chief Washington correspondent for the Boston Herald, has a lot of good insight on the Supreme Court. Kimberly, welcome back. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I've seen the word spirited in describing how the gerrymandering argument went yesterday at the court. Tell me a little bit about it. Give me the inside scoop on what it was like.
Yeah, it was a very spirited discussion indeed by the justices and the attorneys arguing this case about whether gerrymandering on the basis of partisanship raises a constitutional question. And if it does, how and should courts get involved in deciding whether a district drawn to favor one party over another has gone too far?
When we did the show, the term that we were using and that our guests were using was extreme partisanship. The court must assume that gerrymandering, because it's done by usually the last word comes from the party in charge, is going to be partisan. How is the court wrestling with this idea of when partisan is too partisan to be fair?
Yeah, that was one of the biggest issues at the argument yesterday. And as you point out, yes, if a party is in control of a state house and they have the power to draw state legislative districts and congressional districts, that's sort of one of the spoils of being in power, right? You get the opportunity to draw this, and of course you're going to draw it in a way that's favorable to your party. But there is a point where it goes too far. But how do you measure that? So the court really struggled with what kind of test can we impose to say what is how far is too far. And there were some tests that were offered by the challengers that look at mathematical and sociological data. But the Chief Justice John Roberts at one point expressed some apprehension about courts adopting things like that. At one point, he said to him, these tests looked like sociological gobbledygook. and he really expressed concern about putting courts in that position to apply these tests to determine who wins. He also seemed very concerned that the Supreme Court, even if they put a test in place and followed it to the letter, when these cases come before it, that in the end, the intelligent man on the street, as he put it, would see the court as picking a Democrat over the Democrats over the Republicans, or the Republicans over the Democrats. And he worried about how that would harm the image of the court as the neutral arbitrator and not a political body.
I saw that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg asked what's really behind all of this, and then she answered her question, the precious right to vote. Who do you think are the key swings on the? Does it always come back to Kennedy on this, or are you seeing some other interesting choices being made, maybe by some of the justices?
Yeah, I think this is yet another case where this will come down to Justice Anthony Kennedy. As you said, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and some of the other more liberal-leaning justices, Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Justice Elena Kagan, all expressed a lot of concern about what Justice Ginsburg talked about, the right to vote. Because in these cases, I mean, in the case of the Wisconsin map, you have a situation where Republicans did not get a majority of the votes in state legislative races, but they won a pretty strong majority of the number of seats in the state house. And that essentially seems to be overriding the will of voters. It's a lot of voters who are casting what challengers are calling essentially wasted votes. So there was a lot of concern by some of the justices that they were really being disenfranchised here. And then on the other side, you had the concerns raised by Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito and others about the workability of courts coming in and essentially second-guessing the decisions of elected officials. There's a lot of concern about doing that. I think Anthony Kennedy is going to be the one who decides this one.
Is he also going to be the one who decides this religious discrimination case out of Colorado with the baker who doesn't want to bake the wedding cake for the
gay couple who's about to get married. Will he be key on that, too?
I think that he will. I mean, in that case, we know the newest justice, Justice Neil Gorsuch, has in his past decisions and writings been a very strong advocate for religious freedom. And that's, you know, an aspect of this case. It's although it's technically a First Amendment free expression case. It's basically whether or not these cakes talk, essentially, and create a First Amendment right that you can't force somebody to condone a message that they have a religious objection to. It's that religious freedom aspect of it that will probably resonate with Justice Gorsuch. So you'll probably get a very similar split on this court, and Justice Anthony Kennedy will be the one who will decide it, just as he's decided other big cases, including the second, the same-sex marriage case that he wrote the deciding decision on.
So while we're talking about individual justices here for a minute, I've been curious about what people who sit in the room or cover the court closely are seeing in the way that Gorsuch interacts with his colleagues. I know he's still fairly new, but what are you taking away from his the way he plays with the rest of the court?
Yes, he is someone who jumped right in when it comes to oral arguments. I mean, I've been there for the first oral argument of the last three or four justices to be installed to the court. And one thing that struck me as a little different about Justice Gorsuch is sometimes the newest justice will wait a while before jumping in and asking a question, or won't really mix up with the other justices. They give extra deference when someone else wants to talk. Justice Gorsuch didn't do that. He jumped right in. He asks very probative questions. He asks a lot of questions. So in that way, he is like Justice Antonin Scalia, who he replaced on the court, a very active justice, someone who really pinpoints the weak spots in an attorney's argument, and they have to be on their toes when they come before him. We also saw a lot of interplay between the justices, including with Gorsuch yesterday, where sometimes the justice, one justice will answer the question of another justice without
really
allowing the, kind of taking the attorney off the hook a little bit. And we saw that a little bit, some interplay between Justices Gorsuch and Ginsburg yesterday. So yes, he's definitely an active member of the court. Hmm.
Kimberly Atkins is with us. If you've just tuned in, she's chief Washington correspondent for the Boston Herald. And we asked her to, as we do with new Supreme Court terms, to kind of give us the inside scoop on some of the cases that are before the court, and I'd say the interpersonal relationships between the justices, because that's super interesting, too. If you have questions about cases or individual justices, I'll throw the phone number out here, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and you can reach me on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Just a word about Scalia, since you mentioned him. I heard a bit of an interview with Justice Scalia's wife about some of the things that he wrote and the decisions and what went on behind the scenes. And the bit of the interview that I heard, she would, I mean, in full awareness that he was somewhat of a flamethrower, sometimes he would come to her and say, "What do you think of this? This is what I want to say." And she'd say, "You're going to say that? That might be a little too much." Gorsuch is not a justice maybe in the kind of personality that Scalia was. What would you say on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still a little too early to know exactly how, certainly in his decisions and the way he'll write those. But he seems to be pretty plain spoken in the court. It's not hard to figure out what his concerns are about a case. It can contrast to someone like Justice Samuel Alito, who also asked very probative questions, but he asked them in the form of hypotheticals, sort of one after another, pushing a point a little further and further. You may not know at the beginning what he's getting at, but he kind of takes you slowly on the road there. Justice Gorsuch really puts it out there much more plainly and is much more direct in that sense. So I think that he could be similar to Justice Scalia over time in that way.
Do you think Scalia felt like his role as someone who was willing to say some things that, I don't know, pushed etiquette or that some of the other justices wouldn't say, that he felt that that was an important role to occupy on the court?
I think so. I think it was very clear that he saw oral arguments as a way. He knew that the justices were not only signaling what they thought, but that they were sometimes signaling to other justices as well, oftentimes Justice Kennedy, in order to try to persuade him during the course of the argument. And I think Justice Scalia would put his views out there very plainly to make it clear that, A, I don't agree necessarily with what you're trying to persuade this justice on, and I don't think you should be doing that. This is what it is. This is how I see it. It's pretty plain. I think he also enjoyed the attention. I don't mean that in a bad way, but he was very funny. He was very engaging. And I think he enjoyed oral arguments. I think he enjoyed being that sort of thunderous voice in the marble courtroom in that way. So I think he definitely relished that part of the job.
You know, he was a guy who projected a lot of certainty. And I always wondered, I mean, did he inhabit that kind of certainty, or was that his projection and role as he saw it on the court? And maybe he was much more ambivalent about some of these cases that came before. I always got the sense that he already knew what he was going to, what he thought about many of these cases. What's your sense of that?
Yes, I think I agree, especially over time, especially, you know, in the last years of that he was on the court, it seemed pretty clear he knew what he thought the right answer in a case was, and he really dropped any sort of appearance of ambivalence in that, and that he was sort right. of, you know, still on the fence. He made it very clear. Not every justice shows their hand during oral arguments. Justice Kennedy certainly doesn't. But then you have people on the opposite sides, like the late Justice Scalia and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, which pretty much spell out to you how they're going to rule in a case during the course of an oral argument, and just sets it out there.
Call for you, Kimberly, on this Colorado case to John in Northfield. Hey, John, what are you curious about?
Well, I'm thinking that if the court says it's okay for a baker not to bake a cake for a gay wedding, then what's to stop a doctor from saying, I'm sorry, I don't agree with your religion, you're Jewish, you're Christian, you're Muslim, you're whatever, I'm not going to provide services for you.
Are there implications of that, Kimberly, in this case?
Yes, and that's precisely the argument that the one side is making in this case, is that if you allow, in this case, it's a state law that prohibits discrimination on the base of sexual orientation, and the challengers are trying to get the baker accepted from the state law, saying that state law could force people to speak against their beliefs. But that's precisely the argument that is being made, that if you do this, it's a slippery slope. And where do you draw the line? Where do you draw the line from people objecting on the basis of race, or objecting on the basis of national origin, or something else? So that is definitely a part of the argument that you will see. I think it's probably one of the more stronger arguments in the case.
Call here from Sheila in Minneapolis. Hi, Sheila. What do you want to know?
Yes, I'd like to ask your guest. I'm fascinated in the gerrymandering case about the gender split among the justices, and I know those justices tend to be more liberal justices, but I'm wondering about the implications of this further in further cases where the, you know, female justices are really going to stay on one side of an issue.
Yeah, interesting question. Kimberly.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't notice, honestly, the gender split in this case so much as but I have noticed it in others. I mean, there have been cases, challenges to, for example, the Obamacare requirement that employers cover birth control and contraceptives for their employees. And in that case, you really did see the three female justices sort of coming together and talking about that issue in a way that seemed different from the approach that the male justices were taking. I didn't see that so much yesterday. I saw it more ideological about this push that we talked about between the idea of protecting the right of voters to have their votes count or this other issue of putting courts in the position of second-guessing legislatures when they make their decisions about how their districts are drawn.
So there's been open conversation about Kennedy's retirement because I assume he's left little breadcrumbs that he's thinking about this. Is that right, Kim?
That is. I mean, it seems the conventional wisdom seems to shift over time. It seemed like it might be imminent, and then it was thought that it wouldn't be imminent at all, and he'd be on for this term and probably the next. Again, I'm hearing from folks that it could come maybe at the end of this term or sometime soon after. So it's definitely a part of the scuttlebutt here in Washington.
Which would be a huge change for the court since he ends up being the swing vote so often.
It would. It would have a dramatic impact on the court. It would turn the court from an almost evenly split with perhaps a slight tilt to the right to a conservative majority that would make a big difference in cases, that we see going forward. We're already seeing how the addition of Justice Gorsuch, as opposed to Merrick Garland, who President Obama nominated, has made a difference in some cases. There are a couple of immigration cases that might be decided differently this term based on that change. There's a case involving public unions that is almost definitely going to go in a different direction than it would have if Justice Garland were on the court. So it will definitely, the addition of another Trump appointee will definitely have a rightward shift of an impact on this court.
Does it look to you like Ruth Bader Ginsburg is there to stay for a while?
She's going to stay there as long as she draws breath, I think. I mean, I don't think that there's
wow.
a chance that she's going to retire. I just don't think so. She points to folks like Justice John Paul Stevens, who retired and several years ago now, and he's still alive and he's still pretty active. And he once said that he regretted it, and I don't think she wants to have that same regret.
Kimberly, always a pleasure. I know you are a busy woman. I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
It's always good to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
You too. Kimberly Atkins is chief Washington correspondent for the Boston Herald and with us to talk about the new Supreme Court term from Washington.